Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now, our business review panel that I told you about, they're here, they're ready for action. Delighted to be joined this morning by Susan Hayes Cullerton. She's the presenter of Taking Stock here on News Talk. Also joined by Kieran Hancock, who's the business editor with the Irish Times. Good morning, one and all, on this bright and sunny Saturday morning in July.
Morning,
Everybody's
Bobby.
Everybody's in good form, I hope.
Absolutely.
Well, let's start with inheritance tax to see if we can get our form to improve, Susan. Jack Chambers is saying that the government wants to address the worry about significant tax burdens for grieving sons and daughters.
That's right. So Mary Regan speaks about this. Just to put this in context, that as of today, one can inherit up to €400,000 from a parent. That's category A, €40,000 from an uncle or an aunt, and then €20,000 without any, from anybody, we'll say, before the 33% capital acquisition tax takes root. So the question here is that would those rates change given the rise of asset prices? I think, though, we're looking at this from one dimension only, I think, actually, Bobby. I think this is a conversation that's going to come up in a couple of years, and I think corporation tax is preventing us from having it today. So first of all, and this doesn't come up in the piece, but just to give the context to this, €295 billion is going to be transferred in this country over the next 20 years, and 200 odd billion of that is going to be in property. About 23 odd billion of that is going to be business wealth, and only 50 billion is going to be in money. But here's the thing, only 0.7% of our tax take today is taken from inheritance tax, and about 50% of people don't expect to receive anything. So the conversation here that's being had is only likely to affect a certain cohort of the population.
A very small group of people.
Well, a concentrated
group. And also, you've got family scenarios where you're a single, where there's a single child versus a big family. The way inheritance tax is calculated can be disproportionate.
And what if there is no child at all? And
Correct.
What, of course, if there is a situation where, and this is the way Ireland is going, where there may be somebody who's inheriting, but not from directly a parent or indeed an aunt or an uncle. So the reason I'm saying I think corporation tax is holding us back from having this conversation is we don't have to worry about the income on tax, or the other way around, the tax on income or on wealth that is arising from this. But I think this is where we're looking at a future social conversation. And I think we'll be looking back to times now when I'm not quite sure we're keeping up.
So you think that if pressure comes on corporation tax, this is the place they're going to go to look for more money?
Oh, because, well, this is how you broaden out the tax base. But The interesting thing I think about this, and in right throughout the conversation here, is we're only talking to people who have assets and who are likely to inherit them. What you rarely hear in pieces like this is from people who don't expect to inherit anything. And so therefore, even though there may likely be a larger cohort of the population who is unaffected by inheritance, I don't think we're talking to them.
Yeah. All right. Kieran, Cliff Taylor, in your own paper, widens out the piece. He talks about it, but he also talks about, you know, this time of year and the whole budgetary kite flying that happens. But he thinks that there'll be real pressure on the coalition this year around because of this forthcoming budget.
Well, Simon Harris has made it very clear that there's going to be a package of tax cuts, if you like. So it just depends how that is structured. And obviously, there's going to be a lot of negotiations going on between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil right up to budget time in October. So Cliff is saying that there will probably be a tax and welfare package of the order of €3 to €4 billion, which is quite substantial. And there's going to be a lot of horse trading going on around that. So we mentioned inheritance tax. That's one element of it. The other element is around income tax. So they will probably structure it in a way that Cliff is saying here, his prediction is that, let's say, a two-income couple household will get something of the order of €20 a week as a result of the changes. So in terms of the higher rate of income tax that applies, 40% at the moment, it's set at 44,000 for a single person, 53,000 for a one income couple. So he's predicting that that will increase. We should remember that last year, all the money basically went on the VAT cut for the hospitality business. So there was little or nothing in terms of income tax moves for individuals. He has a few other predictions in the piece as well, and he's saying that there will be some probably some clever calculating done, a bit of accountancy done to hold spending at about 6%. The reality is that spending will go above 6%. But they will structure it in such a way that on budget day it'll look as if spending is going to be held at 6%, and they'll sort of make out that that's a good thing. But 6% is a lot.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's almost double the rate of inflation at the moment.
Sorry, Kieran. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know he's saying as well that there will be moves as well in terms of childcare costs and so forth. And we know, of course, that Simon Harris is also planning to introduce a savings scheme to try and unlock some of the retail savings that people have on deposit.
Susan, his final prediction is that Budget 2027 is going to test the coalition. Would you subscribe to that?
I would. I would indeed, because I remember a long time ago when things were highly austere, I remember Leo Varadkar saying, he said, our challenge is to be equally unequal to equally unfair to everybody. The challenge with having a lot of money, and when you're looking at it, 9 to 10 billion euro available, well then of course everybody says, well sure, there's money for this. What I think is particularly striking is this is the same week that we had a letter from the central bank to Simon Harris saying that there is no need for any fiscal stimulus into the country at all. I'll be interviewing Seamus Coffey about that in the morning on my own show, and you can imagine what he's likely to say about that. But the reality here is that I'm not quite sure that I'd agree, Kieran, that all the money went to the hospitality cut, the hospitality VAT cut last year. I think there was certainly other measures that were taken, but indeed the focus on income tax, that the income tax cut this time around will probably take centre stage. And then, of course, you're naturally enough going to have the big issue, which is cost of living, particularly in the piece as well. Cliff talks about energy, childcare, disability and third level. And it is likely as well that we're going to have a focus on business here. So I think, of course, there is going to be a fractious nature of this conversation. And the likelihood is the quantum of money available is going to lead to that.
Yeah. Kieran, interesting story with possible acquisition of PayPal by Stripe in today's Examiner. Somewhat speculative, some unnamed sources, etc., giving views, but it does seem to be, you know, the numbers are big. PayPal have had some difficulties, and this is a potential way out for them. But as I say, 53 billion being dismissed as not enough by the PayPal board.
Yeah, so Stripe, which of course was founded by the Collison brothers, it has come together with a private equity firm called Advent International and bid $53 billion for PayPal. PayPal was founded in the 1990s and one of the biggest payment platforms. People will be very familiar with it. But in recent years, it's kind of lost ground because Apple Pay and Google Pay have come along. They're easily available on your phone and a lot of people have migrated towards those. So PayPal has been struggling in recent years. It has a management team that's currently working on a turnaround strategy. And it has, well, according to this report, it has dismissed the bid that's been put on the table by Stripe and Advent for $53 billion as not being enough and not recognising the value of the company. Now, this piece is sort of suggesting the shares of PayPal were up 2% on Thursday. So there's a couple of routes it can go. Obviously, Stripe and Advent could come back potentially with a higher bid, and that often happens in these kind of situations. Another bidder might emerge.
True.
Out of the woodwork, or the PayPal board might simply double down and decide that the turnaround strategy is the best for the company. I mean, obviously, shareholders are going to decide on this at some point, but I would imagine that Stripe and Advent will come back with another bid. There are some concerns as well around because of the size of Stripe and the size of PayPal, put the two of them together and you could potentially have competition issues.
Yeah, which
and regulatory
could slow down the
issues.
Process a lot.
Yeah, so that is an issue. Financing is also an issue. I think the advisors to Stripe and Advent are trying to persuade PayPal that they have the funds in place and they can execute on this deal. So we'll see how it plays out.
Do you know who's really making money here? It is the US investment banks. I mean, I've been watching what has gone on.
JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley.
JP Morgan this week, Bobby, came out with their earnings report. They have made the most money in the last quarter in US banking history. They made $100 million alone from the SpaceX IPO. Goldman Sachs made $100 million out of the SpaceX IPO. What is intriguing, in my case, I think, is just the sheer amount of money that is being happening now through through conversations like this, through whether it's mergers and acquisitions, whether it's the volatility in the stock market, who's really making money here is exactly who's in the very last paragraph of this, which is JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley have provided the bidders roughly a $50 billion package and they're going to serve as advisors. That's who's making money here.
Absolutely. And that's how it works, Susan. These guys come along and they say, ooh, PayPal, how much is that worth? X. Yeah, we can get X percentage of X.
Anthropic, and on we go, and on we go.
All right, what about Ryanair? Are they the national carrier by default? According to Matt Cooper, they are.
Well, I mean, if you were to say by virtue of flight volume, you could absolutely argue it, and he does argue it very much. I mean, the piece here is centred around the 500 jobs and cuts, but also as well the 6% reduction in flight capacity in Aer Lingus. So the flights to Denver, Minneapolis and Vegas will be discontinued, as well as the European flight to Split. But also then there will be a move to the Dublin to Seattle, Hamburg, Frankfurt and Malta will all move to summer only. So Matt Cooper's point here is that we think Aer Lingus is the national airline. He says Ryanair is more so. And I think, though, when it comes to what a national airline is, obviously part of it is the name, the representation, you know, the shamrock on the side of the plane. And Aer Lingus really does pride itself on all things being Irish within it. But ultimately, this does come down to price and volume. And when you look at Aer Lingus's role within IAG, which is the International Airlines Group, that it is owned by, from a financial and economic point of view, it has been struggling significantly there as part of the portfolio. So what Aer Lingus have come out and said this week is that, number one, they're recognising it and they're doing something about it, and number two, they're taking capacity off, which means then on the part of passengers there's going to be fewer options available. But there's no doubt about it, given if you look at Ryanair's earnings, it is soaking up all of the capacity that it can. It is 80% of its fuel hedged, so it has been shielded a lot from the volatility and the increase in energy prices, and of course it's continuing to grow all the time.
Yeah, they're probably two different business models at one level, Kieran. You know, Ryanair doesn't fly internationally, but I suppose what comes out when you look at the rationalisation within Aer Lingus is, if you look at the profitability of both businesses, you know, there are comparisons here.
Yeah, but Bobby, what is going on at Aer Lingus, right? This week, the Irish Aviation Authority came out and said it was minded to lower passenger charges for next year at Dublin Airport. So Ryanair immediately came out, welcomed this and said, we'll put an extra 2 million seats into Dublin Airport. They're already taking about 20 million people through Dublin Airport at the moment, right?
Yeah.
So a 10% increase. In addition to that, we had the legislation removing the passenger cap at Dublin Airport signed into law by the President this week. So the cap is going to be gone. So now we can go 40 million plus at Dublin Airport. Dublin Airport is going gangbusters. It can't accommodate the number of passengers coming through it. And yet we've Aer Lingus, it should be a boom time for them, but Aer Lingus is now proposing to cut 8% of its staff.
Yeah.
At a time when, you know, the environment looks really good. Now, of course, there are challenges around fuel costs and so forth, and there's a lot of competition from North American carriers. But it says something about Aer Lingus and the way it's been run over the past few years, that it is now proposing to cut 8% of its staff at a time when air travel out of Ireland is really going gangbusters. And they are different models. There's no doubt about that. There's a price issue here for Aer Lingus in relation to Ryanair. Next month, I'm going over to London for a football match to see my beloved Chelsea play. And I looked at price flights between Ryanair and Aer Lingus. A Ryanair flight into Gatwick, €35. Not taking a bag on board or any of that, just stepping on the plane, stepping
off.
Keep it simple. Aer Lingus into Heathrow, €150. And that was the cheapest with Aer Lingus. There were actually more expensive options as well.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of price pressure they're facing out there. Customers are obviously going to go for a cheaper option in that kind of scenario. But I think Aer Lingus is, I mean, what is going on there?
Yeah, you'd have to ask.
But sure, if the routes aren't making money, Kieran, what are they supposed to do? I mean, what's the point in holding on to routes if they're not making the money? Isn't that the issue that's coming from?
But every year we get new routes that get dropped the following year.
I understand that, but you also have to look at where that's coming from as well. But I mean, in the comparison there of the Heathrow flight, I mean, ultimately Aer Lingus is making an awful lot more money out of going the other way. I mean, where it needs to be more so competitive is against the American airlines in particular.
Well, sorry, they've had two major strategic plays under the current chief executive. One was to put a base out of Manchester, where which has been closed, and they've lost them a lot of money, and they've taken a big hit there. And the other is the European Hope strategy, which isn't hers, basically. That's been in development for a long time. This is where people come from other European countries into Dublin, mm-hmm. and then they go transatlantic. And it's fair to say they're now retreating from some of that strategy. So some of the strategic plays that Aer Lingus has made itself just haven't paid off. And that's why I'm saying, what is going on at Aer Lingus?
Well, then wouldn't you do something about it, which they're changing?
Oh, sure. But at a time when air travel out of Ireland is going gangbusters, and Ryanair is talking about putting 2 million seats, you know, there's something really wrong at Aer Lingus at the moment. We'll see if this resolves it.
Okay, let's move on to Netflix again. Some disappointment there. Shares slide more than 10% in the wake of a disappointing forecast. I thought it was interesting as well, you know, when your corporate speak actually removes a data point from investors, that the stock market actually punishes you for that. And I think this is where they said that they were scrapping subscriber counts, which you would think was a fairly basic measurement of how they were doing.
I've been watching the Netflix earnings calls for several years every quarter, and the key metric they look at is ARM, which is average revenue per member. That's really the one to watch. But I think it's when you look at the Netflix business model, you look at as much good news could have happened when you came to the rise and rise of the customer right across the English-speaking regions. Also, of course, then you had the pandemic. And then remember as well, they had password sharing where they were clamping down on that. So all of the really big things that they did made a big difference. Now, the big things they're focusing on are live events and gaming. And I was very surprised in lots of the commentary about the Netflix earnings call this week. They were very silent on the ads business, which was supposed to be the next big lever that they were due to pull. Picking up on the point about removing data, if it is the case that you're not talking about an element of the business because you don't want people discussing it in an earnings call, what does that say apart from, well, you're hardly going to be hiding
it. The news is bad, is what it says.
And this is in such contrast. I was watching Kevin Walsh this week on The Hill, who is the Fed governor, and he said, we're going to remove forward guidance because we want the markets, and the word he uses, to be more circumspect about decisions that we're taking. The management of Netflix is not Kevin Walsh. So when you're looking at that, the thing is that they want to keep more of their cards closer to the chest. They are saying they've only reached 45% of its addressable market. So I'm wondering, where is the rest of that addressable market? And again, I have watched the earnings call quarter after quarter. It's primarily in non-English speaking regions. So as a result, that can be more expensive in order to do that. And they also say as well that they now account for 5% of global viewing while adding 6 billion in sales this year. So they're up against not just the other streamers, of which they're the largest. They're up against TikTok. They're up against YouTube. And of course, they're also up against terrestrial TV. It's a challenge for Netflix to really keep going here.
I don't know about you, Karen, but I'd much prefer to be going to a Chelsea match than watching Netflix share updates that Susan does every quarter.
This is where the real problem is.
You obviously didn't watch Chelsea much last season, Bobby.
You're watching the wrong stuff, the Perry.
What about housing, Kieran? Orla Hegarty, she contributes a lot on the subject. She's the assistant professor at the School of Architecture out at UCD. There's been a lot of talk about the garden cabins, rural sprawl, and tiny apartments. Housing is increasing, becoming a numbers game, but she's commenting that with all these changes that are being suggested and made, bizarrely, these reconfigured buildings will fit fewer people. It seems that a lot of the ducks don't seem to be aligned here.
Yeah, it's a good piece. Orla's been commenting on the housing market now for many years and doing so in a very good way. She's making the point that the policy at the moment is build, baby, build, to sort of Donald Trump. Just build housing, build it anywhere, get it up. The government wants local authorities to zone more land, and it just wants more housing, more housing, more housing, because obviously that's been the demand from citizens over the past decade or so. But, you know, she's making the point, and rightly so, that it comes with consequences in terms of climate change and in terms of sustainability. It's leading to a lot of urban sprawl. And now they're talking about more housing in the countryside, sort of one-off housing in the countryside.
I think the main point she was making was that there's all these policies, but there's no policy of where.
Exactly, in other words, there's no joined-up thinking, if you like. And there's a cost to doing a lot of this, to allowing the urban sprawl, to allowing one-off housing in the countryside, or to allow villages to continue to spread outwards. And we're putting people in cars and making life a little bit more unsustainable. It's it has an impact on in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and so forth. And there's just no joined up thinking. But as I say, at the moment, people want more housing, and therefore the government is just determined to build.
And did you see that we also had 6,300 derelict homes now back in use? That's actually good news.
Yeah, it's some good news. Yeah, this is a policy.
Some progress there.
This is a policy that's been in place since 2022, and there are substantial grants of €50,000 available for people who can bring existing homes back into use, homes that have been derelict. And certainly in country areas, it seems to be well used, particularly in Cork and Donegal. There are figures cited in that.
I don't think this gets enough attention, actually. I think that the €50,000 grant that's available, that can really make a difference. It solves two problems. It creates a new property, but it also prevents dereliction. And I think a lot more people, if they knew about that, really would avail more of it. And I think that definitely...
I think it's becoming more widespread, and people are starting to... I think there was some issue around when the money was paid out. And I think that's been addressed.
I don't know if to, as regards that issue, but when it comes to the fact that you can get €50,000, but the key thing is that the vacant house has to be turned into a permanent home or rental property, and a €20,000 top up is available. But these are available right across the country, and there's a lot of properties that could avail of this, even more so.
And with SEAI grants as well, there's a fair bit of red tape involved.
There is. You've got to know your way around it.
Yeah.
So you're not going to Croke Park tomorrow, is that what you're telling me, Susan?
Are you going to Croke Park tomorrow?
No, I'm
talk
not.
About hitting off a sore point here. Well, so neither of us
we're
are,
all
right?
Losers. We're all losers. So there's behind the scenes at Croke Park, from catering to logistics and pitch repair. So we'll talk about anything but the game. Let's talk about the infrastructure. 80,000 people will attend the game, a small city gathering on Dublin's north side. Peter McKenna and others telling about what happens behind the scenes at Croker on All-Ireland Days.
Like, no matter whether I'm there or not, and look, I'm not. I was there a couple of days ago, and we won't go any further into that. However, look, unfortunately, I have been at All-Ireland finally for a number of years now at this point, being an avid Cork supporter. But the day itself is just, it's a fantastic day out. I mean, if anybody was to drop from Mars or anywhere from outside of Ireland and go to Croke Park and All-Ireland Day, I mean, just the whole sentiment, and also as well the sheer amount of logistics that's involved. Like, I mean, you've the SLUA, as they put up on the screen, is over 82,000 people. There's going to be 2,000 crew in addition as well. Notwithstanding the hose pipe ban, there's going to be 500,000 to 1 million litres of water that is going to be invested into the infrastructure itself. But I mean, if you look at the amount of people who will be there, it's actually more than double the amount of people who live in Leitrim. Just to put that in context, in one small space, and just the atmosphere, the hair stand up in the back of your neck when you stand up there and you're singing Aron Aveen. It's brilliant. And so look, best of luck to both teams. May the best team win in what's another year.
Kieran, just finally on Taco Bell, their lettuce blamed for some serious epidemic across the US. They're also coming to these shores, I believe.
Couple of stores here already, yeah.
Yeah. So, but this is it's a serious outbreak right across a number of states. A Taco Bell spokesman said that the potentially impacted lettuce had been removed from restaurants nationwide and will be replaced within 24 hours in select states. So hopefully you're not a customer within those 24 hours when they're replacing the lettuce.
Apparently more than 7,000 confirmed cases. Some dodgy lettuce is being blamed for this, and it's affecting people in 34 states. It's a big chain in the United States. If you go on YouTube or the internet or whatever, you'll see people doing various reviews of Taco Bell. I've never heard of it getting a good review, and this certainly won't help them, and particularly in terms of their plans for Ireland, because I think they do have a number of new stores.
All right, but we'll leave it there. Thanks for a great review of the business stories and indeed the papers to Susan Hayes, Cullerton, and indeed Kieran Hancock.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr. Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. conversation that counts.